A young electrician dies in excruciating pain. Analysis of his hair will help determine whether he was poisoned or murdered. Within weeks of each other, a police officer's wife and mother-in-law both die of what appears to be heart attacks. A clue suggests that the murder was a homicide and that the perpetrator was leading a double life. An engineer with no apparent health problems mysteriously falls ill and dies. A bounced check, Zach, sparks an investigation. Poison is a silent killer, but it always leaves a mark. With the help of a variety of forensic techniques, detectives can now follow the trail and identify those who inflict invisible death. In Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, on the evening of September 7, 1991, an ambulance was dispatched to the residence of Robert and Joan Curley. Joan told the paramedics that her husband appeared to be in great pain. The paramedics were unable to identify the cause of his illness, but they noted that his vital signs were dangerously low. They rushed the 32-year-old electrician to the hospital immediately. The doctors were already familiar with Robert Curley. A few days earlier, he had been treated for a very rare nervous disease. He had complained of pain in his hands and feet and severe nausea. He had also suffered from severe hair loss. As these symptoms worsened, the doctors now had to revise their diagnosis. The hospital neurologist ran new tests, this time to check whether the patient had been exposed to toxic chemicals. 2 weeks later, the doctors confirmed that Curley's symptoms were due to poisoning by thallium, a heavy metal. Until the early 1970s, thallium was widely used in pesticides. Scientists then realized that prolonged contact with concentrated solutions of thallium could be fatal. Thallium was therefore banned from everyday products and authorized only for industrial purposes. Forensic toxicologist Frederick Reuters explains the effects of thallium poisoning. It is a poison that attacks the nervous system. Very often it starts with a burning sensation in the feet, then paralysis begins to set in. You can no longer walk, and soon you can no longer use your arms. Then your eyelids droop, then your neck weakens, and finally, your brain and heart. Your entire body is affected. It is a very insidious poison. For Robert Curley, it was already too late. The damage had been done, and the situation was unfortunately irreversible. Robert Curley suffered a violent heart attack. He was put on a respirator. Shortly afterwards, he was declared brain dead. His wife, Johan, gave her consent for him not to be kept on life support. A few hours later, Robert Curley was pronounced dead. The official cause of death was cardiopulmonary failure from thallium poisoning. The next step was to try to figure out where and how he had been exposed to the toxic substance. An occupational health and safety officer began investigating. According to Joan Curley, Robert had been working on a major renovation project at the local university campus before his death. Shortly after his arrival, Curley had told co-workers that he thought he had the flu, but by the end of the first week, he could barely walk. His feet felt as heavy as blueprints. He was sweating profusely, and his face was red. He was preparing to spend the next month commuting to and from the hospital. On campus were laboratories and chemical storage facilities, including 5 containers of talium salt. The occupational health and safety officer began a thorough examination of the lab. It was imperative to eliminate the source of the poison to prevent anyone else from getting sick. The team of experts collected numerous air samples and analyzed numerous objects in several rooms. Examination of the containers revealed no signs of any damage or leakage. The experts later learned that Curly had stored cabinets in his garage that had come from the university's chemistry lab. Curly's garage was thoroughly searched, but again, there was no trace of talium, not even in the university's cabinets. John Curly then decided to call the hospital toxicologist to learn more about her husband's death. She was terrified that she and her daughter might have been exposed to the poison. She demanded that both be tested. It was soon discovered that Joan Curly had thallium in her system, but not at a toxic level. As for her daughter, her system contained even less, 10 times less than her mother's. By comparison, Robert Klee's contained 900 times the toxic dose. The doctors were certain they could not have poisoned themselves through their skin. He had ingested thallium. The hospital forwarded the results of the test to the police. Robert Curie had not committed suicide, and the poisoning was not accidental. He had been murdered. But who could have wanted to take his life? To find out, they would have to piece together every detail of the last few days. The police collected several items from her home. Joan told the detective that her husband took a 2-liter thermos of iced tea with him to work every day. In the evening, the family shared the leftover tea with them at dinner. The experts requisitioned the thermos for analysis. They also collected 2 other thermoses, one with a capacity of 1 liter and the other 500 milliliters. According to Joan, her husband had never taken them with him to work. All these objects were analyzed. In the meantime, the police continued their investigation. They questioned Robert's colleagues. About 150 workers were working on the renovations on the campus. Since all these men were at the very place where Robert had fallen ill, they should all be considered suspects. They had to try to find a motive that could have led someone to commit this murder. All these people seemed to like the electrician. Some of them said that Johan had just received a large sum of money. The insurance company had paid her $1 million following the death of her first husband in a car accident. This large sum of money was a source of tension between Robert and Johan. Robert had wanted to use it to start his own electrical business. But Johan had categorically refused. She had no intention of financing the realization of her husband's dreams. A little research led the detectives to discover that Joan was also due to receive $300,000 in the event of Robert's death as the sole beneficiary of his insurance policies. This was enough to put Johan on the list of suspects. However, since his daughter herself also appeared to have been poisoned, it was rather unlikely that she had committed the murder. In the laboratory, the experts analyzed nearly 100 objects collected from the Curly residence. Only two of them contained tantalum. These were the 2-liter thermos that Robert took to work and the 500 milliliters that, according to Johan's statements, had never left the house. This discovery was very important. If Robert's 500 milliliters thermos had been exposed to thallium, it meant that the poison did not come from the university. It therefore seemed that the police had been looking for their suspect in the wrong place all along. The results of the analyses were leaked so that they could be published in the local press. Joan then told police that she remembered a detail that might explain why the thallium was found in the smaller thermos. When her husband was hospitalized, he had called her and asked her to bring him pizza and iced tea to celebrate the departure of the patient who shared his room. Johan had transferred the iced tea from the 2-liter thermos into the smaller one and brought it with her to the hospital. The police could not rule out the possibility that one of Curly's co-workers had committed the murder. Unfortunately, none of them had a motive for killing him. The investigation was at an impasse. It would remain that way for the next 3 years. Three years after Robert Curly's poisoning death, the investigation was turned over to the Pennsylvania State Police. With no leads or suspects, the detectives were faced with a daunting challenge. Sergeant Dev Wandolski was assigned to the investigation.
My goal was to start over and treat this case as if it had happened yesterday.
On August 23rd, 1994, Robert Curly's body was exhumed for re-examination. Samples of his hair and fingernails were collected. The forensic scientist, Frederick Reeders, hoped to gain information by measuring the length of the victim's hair.
Hair allows us to know exactly when the poison was administered. Hair grows at a rate of 8 millimeters per month. By examining the roots, we can therefore see what happened a few days earlier.
The hair samples were examined using an instrument that uses atomic energy. During this analysis, the sample is placed in a graphite tube and heated until it reaches the gaseous piles. A beam of light is shown inside the tube. The amount of light absorbed by the vapor determines whether thallium is present and, if so, how much. Robert Curly's hair contained some surprising information.
The hair was long enough that we could say that the poisoning had started in November 1990, perhaps even earlier. He was then given another dose in March 1991, and a smaller one in April. Then he was given a huge dose in June, and they kept giving him more and more. There was a break, and then we discovered that he had ingested massive doses of thallium just before his death.
The only person who had a motive and who was in constant contact with the victim was Joan Curly. Investigators reviewed her statement again. The most interesting detail was that she said she had brought pizza and iced tea in the 500 mil thermos. when a patient left. This had happened only a few days before the victim's death. Detectives met with the patient who shared Robert's room, Richard Buchan-Bonin. The latter had a very different version of events than the one Johan had given a few years earlier. According to Bonin, neither he nor Robert Curley had asked Joan to bring them anything to eat or drink. Nor had he celebrated his departure, since he was not due to leave the hospital for a few days. According to Bonin, Curley's condition had worsened that evening. He was screaming in pain. Bonin had immediately rung the bell for help. He clearly remembered Joan serving iced tea from a 2-liter thermos. Police believe Joan administered the last dose of poison to her husband while doctors tried to save his life. On December 12, 1996, Joan Curley was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Hoping to have her sentence reduced, she saw her crime. A few months after her marriage to Robert, she had realized that she had made a mistake. She had initially considered filing for divorce, but the prospect of collecting Robert's life insurance policy won out. She had discovered an old jar of rat poison in the basement and decided to use it. That way, she could get rid of her husband and collect the $300,000 Nollers. John regularly added the poison to his iced tea. To divert suspicion, she had ingested a small amount and also given it to her daughter. For a time, these diversionary tactics worked. Johan Curley evaded justice for more than 5 years. Johan Curley was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison in the Pennsylvania State Penitentiary. Curley poisoned his victim over a long period of time. Other murderers are less methodical, but their methods are no less deadly. In this case, the names of the victims and the murderer have been changed. On January 30, 1985, Patrolman Walter Wall rushed to the hospital. As a veteran officer with the Roselle Police Department in New Jose, this was not his first time responding to an emergency call. But this time, it was a personal matter. The doctor informed Wall that his wife, Bette, had fallen and suffered a heart attack. Wall was in shock. His wife had been doing fine when he left for work earlier that evening. B had never suffered a stroke. She had been struggling with her weight, but her health was relatively good. Unfortunately, her condition was getting worse and doctors did not have much hope of saving her. The sudden onset of the attack was difficult to explain. 3 hours later, Bette Wallace died. Bette and Walter had been married for 24 years and had 3 children. Bette's mother, Rose Parker, had been living with them at the time of the tragedy. Due to the sudden and inexplicable death of the animal, her doctor ordered an autopsy. It was determined that the cause of death had been cardiac arrest. A month later, fate struck again in the Wallace family. Rose Parker also suffered a heart attack. Paramedics desperately tried to stabilize her condition and rush her to the hospital, but it was too late. Shortly after arriving, she died.
At the Union County District Attorney's office, investigators learned of the deaths through Rose Parker's attorney. The sudden deaths of two healthy women in the space of just 1 month had aroused his suspicions. He asked investigators to look into Walter Wallace's past. Police Chief Edward Johnson asked the Roselle Police Department to send him Walter Wallace's personnel file. From these documents, a portrait of the man began to emerge.
He had served in several combat units in Vietnam. For some reason, I don't remember exactly what sparked my interest. I was looking at his file and was impressed by the man's past. Then, suddenly, something struck me as suspicious.
Johnson contacted one of the U.S. Army officials to check on Wallace's background.
Wallace had not received any of his medals or been in the special units. In fact, we didn't even know if he had done any military service. The document in his file was a forgery.
So, Walter, Wallace had lied. But we shouldn't jump to conclusions too quickly. In order to learn more about him, detectives decided to interview people around him, such as police officers.
It's always difficult to conduct an investigation when the suspect is a police officer. You have to go to the police department where he works and interview the people who work with him every day. The more you talk to people, the easier it is for them to guess where you're going with this.
Investigators paid a discreet visit to the Roselle Police Department while Wallace was on leave. He hadn't expected his colleagues to be friendly, but one of them surprised them. According to him, Walter's marital status was unclear. He suspected that Walter had married a woman named Jocelyn Deal while he was still married to B. Was Walter divorced or leading a double life? Through Bette's friends, detectives learned that Walton wasn't home much. He had told his wife that he was being treated at a hospital in Virginia because he had been exposed to defoliant gas during the war.
He would leave for a week, sometimes longer, or for the weekend. She hadn't heard from him, nor could she contact him, supposedly, because the hospital wing where he was staying didn't have a phone. For a time, he led this double life with some success.
Detectives went to nearby Elizabeth, New Jose, to interview Wall's other wife. According to Jacqueline Deal, Walter and Walls had been married on November 2, 1984, 3 months before Bette Walls' death. She said Walter had divorced his wife the previous summer. He had brought her the divorce papers after the case was settled, and they had celebrated the occasion. The papers were among the documents provided by Rose Parker's attorney. The document had numerous irregularities. Detectives then went to the county courthouse to retrieve the original papers. There was no document under Wall's name. When they checked the case number, they found that it was the divorce number of another couple. The document clearly stated Martin V. Martin, not Wallace V. Wallace. Wallace had used his authority as a police officer to requisition the Martin's divorce papers. He then forged the document to obtain his marriage license with Jacqueline. Detectives sent the document to the FBI lab for further examination. He had just caught another Wallace in bed, and this latest lie could very well have been the motive for the murder. But it still left investigators baffled. Why had Wall gone to such lengths to fake a divorce and kill his wife rather than simply end the marriage? Detectives began looking for a financial motive and carefully examined the will. Walter was to inherit all of Bia's assets, including the family home. But once again, something in the document caught the attention of the police. The will had been made only months before B's death. It seemed like a coincidence. Further investigation led them to discover the existence of an older will. In this first version, Beth left all her property to her mother. She did not leave a single dollar to her husband. There was a good chance that Wallace had forged his wife's will and then killed her. The New Testament had been notarized by a sworn secretary from the Roseau Police Department. However, the latter claimed never to have seen the document, much less put her name to it. She pointed out to them that Wallace often came to work at her desk. Since the drawer was unlocked, he could easily have used the will without her knowledge. Detectives had accumulated circumstantial evidence against Wallace, but this series of forged documents did not prove a homicide. Detectives in Roselle, New Jersey, suspected police officer Walter Wallace of poisoning his wife. They now hoped to support their circumstantial evidence with a good and formal demonstration of Wallace's guilt. 4 months into the investigation, forensic scientists at the New Jersey Forensic Laboratory reviewed the toxicology results of the animal's tissue, blood, and urine. The autopsy tests had tested for alcohol and illegal drugs. The results were negative. The forensics retested the samples for prescription drugs, heavy metals, and a number of toxins. However, they found nothing that could explain the animal's death. However, one more test remained. Cyanure poisoning. Tissue samples from the victim were placed in test tubes. A dye that reacts with cyanure was added to the samples. The sample turned a deep purple. There was indeed cyanure in the animal system at the time of death. To determine its concentration, the sample was placed in a spectrophotometer. The lethal dose of cyanide is about 2.5 milligrams per liter. In the case of the animal, there was twice as much in its blood and three times as much in its rat. The next step was to try to prove a link between the poison and the suspect, Walter Wallace.
The homicide detectives went to work, knocking on the doors of Russell's factories. We visited them all, even though they were not supposed to have cyanide. We stopped and asked them.
The detectives' work paid off. A clerk at a metal plating company reported that a police officer had come to buy potassium cyanide. He had told him that with this chemical, he could make the serial number on a firearm appear. The clerk was convinced that Wallace was the suspect. On June 18, 1985, the suspect arrived at police headquarters. He was asked to report to the chief's office. He was placed under arrest and escorted to the jail. A search warrant was issued for his residence. The prosecutor requested the assistance of the narcotics team. Only they had the expertise to conduct a thorough search. James Dolkin was part of the team. Once inside the house, we understood why we had been called in. The house was in an incredible state of disarray. That day, one team was searching the attic, another the basement, and we were supposed to meet halfway. The experts collected nearly 100 items. The suspect had hidden a typewriter behind the couch. Legal documents, including the Martins' original divorce certificate, were in a drawer. Upstairs, the narcotics squad opened the hatch leading to the attic. Handwriting samples and a Ford signature page were collected. After only 15 minutes of searching, one of the team members discovered a crucial clue. An empty bottle. The label contained the handwritten inscription, potassium cyanure. The various requisitioned items were sent to the laboratory and examined, along with the divorce certificate and the will. The suspect's typewriter always reproduced the same spacing error, which had been noted on the forged documents. But even more incriminating were the signatures that had been traced. Furthermore, the bottle recovered from Wallace's attic had indeed contained cyanure. As for the label, it had been written in the suspect's own hand. In May 1986, Walter Wall was convicted of bigamy and the first-degree murder of his wife. Police believed that Wall's double life had become too complicated. Rather than file for divorce, he had chosen to kill his wife. But his attempt to finance his new life with the resources of the beast had been his undoing. Wall was sentenced to a minimum prison term of 30 years. He was never charged with the murder of his mother-in-law, Rose Parker, due to lack of evidence. The secret life of this police officer had been the motive for his crime. For other murderers, the motive is much simpler. In this case, the names of the victims and the murderer have also been changed. On July 17, 1991, Dina Jacobs was awakened by her husband in excruciating pain. He appeared to have been the victim of food poisoning. He complained of severe stomach pains, nausea, and diarrhea. The next day, when she realized that his condition had not improved, she decided to take him to the hospital emergency room. She asked neighbor John Ballier to take care of their children. Ballier was worried. Larry had been hospitalized several times in the past few weeks due to gastrointestinal problems. He was admitted again to Humana Suburban Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky. The doctors gave him an IV to prevent him from becoming dehydrated. There was reason for concern. Although he appeared to have the usual symptoms of food poisoning, he did not respond well to the treatment given. The next day, Dana called her neighbor, John Baller, to tell him that her husband, Larry, had died. She asked him not to tell the children until she returned.
It affected us deeply. The children were there with us. They were happy. They had no idea that their father was dead and that their lives were about to change completely.
With Den's permission, an autopsy was performed on the body. Doctors hoped to discover what had killed this 41-year-old man who had always been in good health. Jacobs appeared to have died of a massive heart attack. However, there was no indication of heart disease, and there were no precipitating factors.
The sudden death of this patient was incomprehensible. On Monday morning, John Baller recounted the sad events of the weekend to his colleagues at the Kentucky Prosecutor's Office. Shortly afterward, a colleague of Balier shared some intriguing news with him. His brother-in-law ran a chemical company, and Dina Jacobs had come to his home to make purchases.
She had shown up the same day her husband had fallen ill. She had purchased a product called colchicine. The lawyer's brother-in-law remembered the transaction because the check Denon had given him bounced.
His brother-in-law called and said the check bounced. He thought it was odd that these two events involved the same family.
Bali did some research on the chemical. In small doses, colchicine is used to treat gout. In larger doses, it is toxic and can cause death. Bali phoned Barbara Wickley Jones, the deputy chief coroner of Kentucky.
There is a fine line between a therapeutic level that provides relief from arthritis and one that causes side effects. The main effects are nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. In the worst case, it can cause death.
The usual tests carried out during the autopsy could not reveal the presence of a substance as specific as colchicine. Barbara Wickley Jones took blood and tissue samples from the victim in order to carry out new tests. She was not convinced that she would get positive results. If Jacobs had ingested colchicine, his blood system could very well have eliminated it before he died. Her only hope was to find residues in some of his organs.
Because the gastrointestinal system absorbs colchicine, it is metabolized in part by the liver and eliminated by the kidneys. During the autopsy, it is therefore in these organs that possible residues of the drug must be looked for.
It would take weeks before the results were obtained. The detectives still had to wait to find out if Larry Jacobs had really been the victim of a murder. Larry Jacobs, a 41-year-old father of two, had been struck down by an unknown gastrointestinal illness. John Beer, Jacobs' neighbor and attorney for the district attorney, found the situation suspicious. He assigned Detective Pat Kling of the Jefferson County Police Department to the investigation. The day before the victim's death, his wife had purchased a potentially toxic chemical called colchicine. The first step in the investigation was to meet with officials at the state coroner's office. The results of the toxicology analysis of Larry Jacobs' tissues had finally come back. His system contained 160 nanograms per milliliter of colchicine, an amount more than enough to kill him.
Now it was time to confront Dina Jacobs with the facts. The police were surprised by Dina's welcome.
She invited us in. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary, and she was very friendly with us. She never seemed to hesitate to talk to us.
She immediately admitted to having purchased colchicine. She said she used it in her pool as an algicide. The detectives asked her if she had any left. She said she had used it all up.
I asked her who had told her about the product.
and she gave me the names of several businesses that had suggested she use it to control algae growth.
The detectives called the three businesses DNA Jacobs had mentioned. No one could recall ever mentioning that colchicine could be used as an algaecide. In fact, most of the employees didn't even know what it was. The investigators were at a loss. They knew what had caused Larry Jacobs' death, but they didn't know why. Hopefully, the couple's past would provide some clues. They visited Larry's sister. She told police that the couple was experiencing severe financial difficulties because of Dina's extravagant lifestyle. Family members had lent them thousands of dollars but had never been repaid. Larry had recently confided in his sister that he had tried to take steps to control Dina's spending, but to no avail. All of their credit cards had been maxed out. One of Larry's colleagues even recalled lending him money during a business trip so that he could pay for his meals and hotel room. The engineer had confessed to him that he had no cash or credit. Then there was insurance. Larry had purchased two life insurance policies, one for $138,000 and the other for $25,000. Detectives looked into Dina Jacobs' background. This respectable woman and mother had a disturbing past. Before her marriage, she had been incarcerated for writing bad checks. In her prison file, a psychologist had indicated that she was a pathological liar and should receive psychiatric treatment as soon as possible. Dina Jacobs was arrested and charged with murder in January 1992. Police were convinced they had caught a killer, but a new clue might have cleared her name. 5 months after Larry Jacobs' death, his widow, Dina, was charged with murder. She had posted bail and remained at home with her children. A few weeks before her trial, she claimed to have made a discovery that would clear her name. Her husband had left a letter in which he stated that he intended to commit suicide, that his financial problems were too much to bear. Detectives were skeptical, but the note appeared to have been written in Jacobs' handwriting. Furthermore, Larry was known to suffer from bouts of depression due to his lack of money. Given his background as a chemical engineer, he was likely familiar with colchicine and may have used it to end his life. The letter was sent to Stephen Slitter, a document analysis specialist. The defendant first noticed that two different pencils had been used. In one paragraph, the stroke of a sentence or two was thinner. Then, the stroke was thicker for a few words, and so on. It quickly became apparent that the letter had been fabricated, using words taken from Larry Jacobs' handwriting samples. In the 5 months following her husband's death, Dana Jacobs had spent nearly $200,000, half of her insurance settlement. The suicide note was likely her last-ditch attempt to escape justice. Another incriminating piece of information came from the daughter of John Ballet, the defendant's neighbor.
Sarah Bellier testified in court that she had seen Dina Jacobs filling gelatin capsules with white powder. Dina had confided in her that she was making vitamins to put in her husband's food. She had also told him that this was the only way to get him to take them. According to police, this is how Dina Jacobs managed to poison her husband, who obviously had no idea what was going on. On November 23, 1992, she was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to 28 years in prison. Invisible but deadly. Since ancient times, poison has allowed murderers to act with impunity. Fortunately, science has given detectives new tools. They are now able to lift the veil of mystery surrounding these murders and arrest their perpetrators.